In the world of medicine, where every decision can change lives, your peace of mind is crucial. This is where Pattern steps in. Imagine insurance made simple, fast, and personalized, just for you. With Pattern, you're not just getting disability and life insurance, you're ensuring your future and protecting your greatest asset, your income. In the past 10 years, Pattern has transformed the way over 20,000 doctors secure their financial well-being. Discover the simplicity of securing your future at patternlife.com or click the link in the description. Hey, this is Brad Block, host of The Physician's Guide to Doctoring. This is a personal and professional development podcast for physicians where we have experts on the show that try to teach us everything we should have been learning while we were memorizing Krebs cycle. Welcome back to the podcast. I'm super excited about today's show because I want to introduce you to one of our new guest hosts. Dr. Amna Shabir is the founder and CEO of the Early Career Physicians Institute. She's a Duke certified wellness and life coach, double board certified geriatrician and internist, and super mom to two young girls. And she passionately supports new attending physicians in navigating post-medical training challenges, stuff that we all went through, but she guides people through those challenges that a lot of us just had to kind of like sink or swim, and helping them excel both professionally and personally. Like, her online social media presence is fantastic, ton of traction, great posts. So definitely check her out. And welcome to the show and to the family, Dr. Amna Shabir.
Thank you very much for that kind introduction, Dr. Block. Yes, I certified last year and it's been a tremendous journey because you're always trying to learn more and better yourself, even with this coaching journey that I've been on. And so recently I did also get certified by the National Board of Health and Wellness Coaches. The goal of all of this is really to key in and help early career physicians.
Why early career? Like, something like, for me, you know, I started the podcast because I struggled with that doctor-patient interaction. So I started this so I could get better at it. So something must have happened with you in your early career that you were like, I need to help other people do this better. So what happened?
We all have our very specific and unique journeys. Absolutely. For me, my residency program was very supportive. And overall, I felt that during training, I was very much taken care of despite the overwhelm that just is there in medical education. But when I started out as an early career physician in like the first years of attendinghood, I felt particularly vulnerable, and there was a lack of preparedness and support in a very specific way, such as advocating for yourself, advocating for your needs appropriately, recognizing signs of burnout. What do I do with this? Meanwhile, you're also maintaining this flawless appearance and perfectionism, and you are trying very hard for other people not to know how bad you're suffering from imposterism day in and day out. So why I'm doing all of this is, maybe in a selfish way, I'm helping myself back a couple of years ago. And that journey, that specific time, is we are expecting early career physicians to know everything. And we might give them a little bit of slack when it comes to clinical medicine, but in a way we don't. And we expect them to know systems. We expect them to know metrics. We expect them to do bulk of the work. But they're also just starting out and they're establishing themselves in life, within medicine and also outside of medicine. So a lot's happening at that time.
When you start medical school, throughout medical school, you're consuming a ton of information. You're kind of learning your place in the world there. And that changes with each rotation even. Then when you become a resident, right, as you increase, as you progress through the system, more responsibility, more information, all of it is drink of water through the fire hose. But then those first couple of years of practice is that same thing. It's the same thing. Yes, you're learning a lot of the clinical medicine that you thought you knew in residency, but it's not always the way it was done in your training and thinking on your feet and thinking for yourself. And now it's all on your shoulders. And all of the other stuff you talked about, how do you handle yourself professionally? How you handle yourself socially? How you, like, you meet a patient in the supermarket and like, you're not sure what you're supposed to do. So like, all of these are new experiences, and it's still that drink of water for the fire hose. But now you don't have that mentorship. And I think I had a coach a long time ago on the show, and one of the things he said was there used to be this mentorship when you would enter a small practice and you would join, and it would be one or two other people, and they would be mentoring you. They would be looking out because they would eventually be handing over their practice to you. And we don't have those relationships anymore. And I was a coaching skeptic. And he was like, that's why you need coaching. And this is the need that you're fulfilling. And I think that's amazing.
Thank you. And as we look at systems in place for onboarding physicians, and this can be large organizations, it can be smaller practices, mostly the focus is towards, here's the EMR, here's how our system flows. But there's not a lot of emphasis on checking in on how are you doing overall. And onboarding is flawed. And as a result, retention becomes flawed. The recent MGMA data reveals that early career physicians at this time are leaving their first job in less than 2 years. A couple of years ago, the AMA side had a study that showed after residency, typically residents will stay in a job for about 5 years, and that has now dropped to less than 2 years.
Whoa.
So clearly there's a problem.
Let's start with what you see in your coaching practice, right? So what are some of the common issues that early career physicians struggle with? Let's start with professionally.
I like to marinate the professional and the personal and the psychological and the social.
Okay. I was hoping to untangle that knot, but you're saying it just can't be. It can't be.
We are a whole person. And as much as we like to put things in buckets and categorize, the one problem that stands out across the board is absolute and utter struggle with boundaries. And that's the number one issue. Now, if you ask me, can you break down boundaries when it comes to professional appearance or just in the realms of the hospital versus in what's happening in our mind, it's all about boundaries. So that is front and center, the most important topic we talk about. Because what, first of all, the boundaries start with how you view yourself, your own self-worth. Then you take that same perception of who you are, and the boundaries and the way you view yourself is very closely tied to imposterism and then people pleasing and then the inability to stop. And now how does that show up when you're working? That shows up with you not signing your note when it's done and you waiting to make sure that it's beautiful and it's a Mona Lisa every time. You might be seeing 26 patients now. You don't have time to create a Mona Lisa every time, but the perfectionism and the lack of boundaries is making you do all of that. Then how do lack of boundaries show up when you're having electronic medical record communication with your patients? You are writing back and forth these what I call love letters to your patients, and these are at the end. We want to help. And you come out of training with that fire, except you're not realizing that this fire is the exact problem that's going to end up burning you out. And we're not prepared for that. So when you're in the initial phases for some individuals, when they're ramping up their panel, they mistake that time by them investing more time is also how you are you're training your patients how to treat. You're training everyone how to treat you. So when you're not setting boundaries, that's how it's showing up in just like MyChart messages, for example. I know everyone uses different forms of EMRs, but in-basket management, or what I call in-basket hygiene. You're doing the same thing with yourself when you're not clicking done to that result that you look at. And then you tell yourself every time, I'm going to go and read up, and then I'm going to address this because then I'll have a better answer, so that you're not setting a time boundary with yourself. So boundaries are creating a problem everywhere, be it your charting, be it your communication with your patients, be it the communication with your peers, admin staff, your other support staff in whatever space you're practicing, the clinic space or wards or wherever you are.
We've been trained this whole time to accept more and more responsibility, right? Any opportunity you have to ultimately outshine your classmates, because we're in competition with each other for these coveted spots in medical school and residency programs, it becomes part of our DNA, right? And so how do you convince your clients to unravel that, right? How do you convince them to be like, listen, no, you're in this position now, and if you answer those emails immediately, right? If you wake up in the middle of the night and you're checking the EMR, right? Like, but that's what the patients need. What if it's an emergency? What if it's, right? You're going to get this pushback. So how do you convince them to create those boundaries and that they have this Well, I don't want to give away what I think is going to be the answer.
That's a great question, and it's challenging. A lot of time, the initial work that we will do leads to recognition when we're talking about what is your vision, what are your values, and we're getting in depth with, well, one of the things is I want to have more time to spend with my family. And well, when you're saying yes to one thing, you're saying no to the other thing. But also, I absolutely agree with you that the part of the DNA situation, I like to quote Marian Edelman, her, you can't be what you can't see. And so what you have seen all along is this. But then I also like to add this other quote of mine, and I'm blanking out on who said this, is what got you here is not going to get you there. So first of all, you have to recognize the tremendous transition point that we are going through. This is not training anymore. And people are burning out and people are leaving for a reason. And statistic after statistic, which I'm not going to go in, shows that you are not going to be able to sustain your sleep pattern, your intense mind-body disconnect, that is. And all in all, people are very happy to take everything that you will offer them for free, for everything. And so boundary setting is not supposed to be easy or fun. And the first part is this recognition of what are you losing by not setting the boundaries. And once you start recognizing the loss, the tremendous loss that you're having and the cost-benefit analysis, it's very quick. I like to be very concrete and tangible when I'm coaching my clients. And you just pull numbers and you look at it. Everyone has the same 24 hours in the day. And when you're not getting your sleep, how long are you going to be running on these fumes of external validation? All of that stuff starts to get really old. And then you turn resentful. And that's how the trauma transfer in medicine starts. Because then when I am 10 years in and this younger physician comes in and they're talking about well-being and boundaries and all these other things, I feel like I have been robbed of my time. I did my time. Now it's your turn to do your time.
Trauma transfer. I have not heard that before. And that sounds like kind of the grief we get from the boomers. Well, I had to go through this. So now you have to go through this, right? And the way I did it must have been the right way because it definitely wasn't the wrong way. And so now you're going to, because I turned into this amazing physician. And so the way to do it is to do things the way I do them. And if you're not doing them that way, well, then you're not doing them right.
I love that you shared the word grief and I use the word loss because I have tremendous respect for my seasoned clinicians and my mentors and everyone who has paved the road before us. And their sacrifices have brought us here, but that's exactly what they were, sacrifices and a lot of martyrdom. And this recognition that now it doesn't have to be like a me versus them kind of deal. I think we have to build bridges. And I do call it the trauma transfer cycle in the culture of medicine, because what happens is you work so hard during residency. Most people, by the time they're done with medical training, residency, fellowship, they have already accrued a bit of sadness and grief. And you
bitterness,
have your triggers.
Bitterness. Yeah.
Bitterness. And you're tired. And after that, you start working as an early career physician, and then you start not setting all these boundaries and doing all the people pleasing, getting all the, by the time you reach that phase, then you are absolutely passing along this same, what I would say is dysfunction forward. And so I guess the question for all of us is, even for early career physicians, for especially for attendings who are caring for residents and fellows, when are we going to start normalizing and humanizing medicine?
So how do you help set the boundaries? Like, how do you even know where the boundary goes? Because I sometimes struggle with that. It's like, you know, my staff will come and say, oh, Dr. Block, we have this patient that's calling and they really want to be seen. Like, do you have it? And my answer is always, there's nowhere to squeeze them in because I can't say that you're more important than the person that made the appointment already. All I can do is tack them on to the end of the day, or we can put them on a list for cancellations. But if I tack them on to the end of the day, then I get out later, which means less time with my kids, right? Less time with my wife and my family. So, but like sometimes that stuff I will add on and sometimes I won't, but I don't have like a formula, right? My guess is sometimes it just depends on my mood and sometimes it depends on the perceived urgency of the patient. And sometimes, you know, maybe it's an actual emergency. So like it's very fluid, but so I don't have a formula. How do you help people decide on where the boundaries go?
Well, I do have a formula. I like to start by acknowledging the differences. When we use the term boundaries, a lot of people instantly constrict, or they just, I mean, some people just get nauseated, like, oh my God, like this is going to be this awful thing that I have to do. It's not in my nature to set boundaries. So I like to just do what I call a little bit of myth busting before I go into details with boundary setting. The first thing is boundaries vary for each and every one of us. So we have to recognize the areas. For some people, it might not be at all in the clinical space, and what they need is a boundary at home. Why is that important? Because at the same time, what happens at home is impacting what happens in the clinic. So you have to do the needs assessment of where you are. Is it home or is it in the clinic or in the OR, wherever your clinical space is? Now, once you have narrowed that down, the second thing is setting boundaries can be very culturally variable for all of us, the way we were raised. And so what is acceptable to you might not be acceptable to another human, and that's okay. But at the end of the day, when you feel that nagging feeling and you want to avoid a person, a situation, a circumstance, that's exactly the place where you should be setting a boundary. And so we have this motivational triad, right? We want to avoid discomfort, and we want to see the path of least resistance. And that's really where we're headed as human beings. And so there is nothing comforting about setting a boundary. Now, that's another point. And the next point I'll make is, like, there is a difference between setting a boundary and making a request. And so when you're setting a boundary, you have to follow through with a consequence. And when I say the word consequence, everyone, again, it's a very severe word, but it is very true, because till you say, for example, you gave me the example, the patient comes up late, and the time to actually set the boundary, first of all, was before the patient event happened. So your staff should have understanding, a very clear understanding of what their three options, I always like to give three options, it's easy to remember, are. For example, if the patient shows up this amount late, they will be rescheduled. They can wait till the end of the day, like you said, but there is no guarantee that they might be seen, or they're welcome to see an associate of mine. Now, the exception to this is somebody who has an emergency, a special needs travel situation, there's an ambulance involved, et cetera, but it's very clear. And so after that, if your front desk ignores all of this and still checks in the patient, you can walk in the door. And I'm speaking all of this because I've done it. You can walk in the door, you can still have a smile on your face, you can sit with your patient, and you can say, I really want to honor the time for everyone, for you and for the other patients. And I think that the best way for me to help you would be in the full time that's allotted for your appointment. I'd be happy to see you XYZ. And now when you're going to do this initially, everyone's not going to be happy. And there's a second version of that in which you have previously educated your patients as well at whatever first encounter you had. For example, I would tell my patients, this is the time I have by the time you check in from the front desk to when you get roomed to the whole time you see me and I go through your chronic disease management. And by the time I explained it to the patient, most of them would be like, wow. And I said, technically, I'm also supposed to be done with my note by the end of this visit. And so I actually found allies in my patients by explaining the process to them. And so if the patient showed up, you go in, you explain again, you give them three options, the same three options the front desk has, the same three options your patient has, and then you politely walk them out the door.
Oh.
And that can be
boss move right there.
Difficult, but your patient will respect you when at the end of the day, you're not going to have people waiting in the waiting room getting angry. Patients don't know what you're going through. If you're not going to share, they're not going to know. Everyone wants to be dealt with appropriately. So that's how you have to follow through with whatever clear consequence. And then when you decide a consequence, you can brainstorm with a team.
Leading a medical practice is challenging. There can be reimbursement changes, referral slowdowns, staff turnover, or drama. There are obstacles in the way of achieving your goals, or maybe it feels like you've hit a plateau. Who can you turn to for help with the business of managing a medical practice? The Physician Growth Accelerator, a private practice partner that helps you uncover and overcome constraints in your practice. They will check your business vitals, identify the root cause of what's restricting your growth, prescribe what to do about it, and help you achieve it, just like we do with our patients. Imagine a practice, imagine your practice, where stress is reduced, profits increase, and both patients and staff and you are happier. They've been making that vision a reality for over a decade. Isn't it time your practice thrived? Discover how at physiciangrowthaccelerator.com. It sounds like you probably parent this way as well, because it sounds like there's some parallels there too. And the word consequence is definitely something that we use with our kids. We don't say punishment. It's a consequence,
Yeah.
Same idea. Boundaries. There's so many parallels between parenting and what you're talking about here.
Absolutely. And it's one of my, Dr. Sasha Shilliket has written a very good book, and it's called Brave Boundaries. I highly encourage folks to read it. And in there, she has a quote that if you don't set your own boundaries, other people will be happy to set them for you. So someone is always setting the boundary. The time someone is closing the clinic and going home and you are staying back and charting, they are being set however you want to lean into them. And I want to really just narrow the boundary part. Just the one last bit I want to add to this is, we think that certain people have personalities that they can set boundaries and other people might not feel comfortable. I'm not confident enough to set boundaries. It comes easy for you. That's not the case. It's a learned behavior. Behaviors can be learned. They can be implemented. And if you follow through and repeat it, just like going to the gym over and over again, you might grow those biceps and abs eventually.
And it sounds like there's a lot of positive reinforcement with those. And once you get comfortable doing it, then it's going to come a lot more easily. But those first couple of times, there might be some, just like learning any other new skill, it's going to be uncomfortable. You're not going to be very good at it. But then with some positive reinforcement, you'll want to do it and want to do it, and then you'll get better at it.
Absolutely.
So I'm taking on a new role in my practice where I'm going to be working with our mentorship committee. And so something I would like to know, because I am firmly mid-career now, right? The hair is starting to fall out. The belly's starting to happen. I'm mid-career. So for those of us who are mid or late career and are mentoring early career physicians like you, what should we be focusing on? Like, what have we forgotten that we should be remembering? What are those struggles we should be helping them with? Aside from like boundaries, we've covered boundaries, but aside from that, what should I be thinking about for them?
I would do what remembering exercise and think back to the time, literally just close your eyes. What was the first day that you started out as an attending like? And how was life in the clinic? And imagine that time. How was life at home for you? Had you found your home? What was the situation with your partner, your spouse? Were there children involved? Was your wife expecting? So like literally think of that time in your life and then kind of try to remember what it felt. Why is that important? Because the more time passes, the more you might only be remembering either really good or really bad things. And most often we end up suppressing the bad ones. And then we think that, okay, whatever bad happened, it's okay. Like, it's fine. I earned the scars and, you know, this is all great. And so if you can remember, first of all, it creates compassion for your colleague that is just starting out. The second thing is when you remember, also verbally share. I remember how hard this was. When you share, you normalize their experience because they're not telling you, oh my goodness, I'm having a massive exacerbation of imposter syndrome right now. They're going to be trying to be very calm. Yes, give me that project. Give me the extra patience. It's okay. It's okay to then make this like destigmatize that time for them and normalize the experience. Another very important thing to remember right now is a lot of the early career physicians trained during the time of the pandemic. The conversations that I have is scarring. A lot of times when you cannot graduate if you don't show up in a space clinically, and you have seen a lot of things that are morally distressing on your MICU and CICU and other ICU rotations as the pandemic was at its peak, there was not even like you couldn't even meet your mentors face to face. So that has left scars on early career physicians as they're entering practice. So remembering how that felt for you as well, and remembering that experience as you lean forward. And lastly, is stopping that trauma transfer cycle, right? Stopping the trauma transfer cycle. You want to not appear like somebody who is judging and who is being resentful. I have always had amazing colleagues. My senior colleagues were there for me. Like when I look back at that time when I was going through this struggle, there was a lot of loneliness that was there. But when any of them shared a story, even humor can be amazing. One of them shared a story when they had to deliver a baby with one glove because the ER that they were covering ran out of gloves at that time. And so it broke that issue that I was going through. It was my first week starting out as an attending. And one of my senior colleagues just looked at me and he said, "Amna, remember, you are not the patient." And he was so serious. And I laughed and always remember, you are not the patient. And it's just humor and being there always for your colleagues in that capacity. As a human, it's okay. You also don't have to pretend to be who you are. There's a great healing that just comes with commiseration. And even if you're there as you're just in your human form and less as a physician form, I think that would be huge.
Well, fantastic advice. So one more piece. There's one more little bit of information I want from you before we close, although it might end up becoming a bigger thing. And that's, what advice would you give to your younger self? To your, at any point of your training, although I'm thinking we're probably going to focus on early career physician.
If I look back in my life, the one piece of advice I would give myself is the practice of self-compassion. And when we say self-compassion, it doesn't come to mind in medical education at all. In fact, some people mistake it for, is she trying to tell herself to be lazy? Then how is she going to get to where she was supposed to be by being self-compassionate? All the research that I have read and studied so far and now cultivating and practicing it in a very real way, you know, I'm not a big meditator so far, but I just try to practice mindfulness in the moment. By being self-compassionate, you actually are intrinsically more motivated, so you don't have to beat yourself up to practice self-compassion. As a self-compassionate human, you ask yourself, what is good for me? Instead of when you're self-critical, you say, am I good enough? And that's a huge change. By being self-critical, you're activating your fear responses. By being self-compassionate, you're activating the opposite. Your vision broadens. You actually procrastinate less. And if I was just to go back in time, I would tell myself to go a little easy because my self critical part of my existence is very strong. And I think that probably started to go easy on myself a little bit on that part
a year ago.
And I think that this is another thing as a coach, I want to also normalize and humanize. Like, it's not like just because I became a coach and I've been coaching for a year and more, now all of a sudden I have Zen and there's no struggle. There's always struggle. It's just recognizing what to do. It's just like in clinical medicine, you don't always have all the answers, but you know where to go look for them. And really the big one advice I would say is self-compassion. And self-compassion also bleeds into objectivity because why do I say this? My existence as a human and my worth as a human are not directly proportional to every outcome of every exam and every encounter with a patient. As I practice self-compassion, it allows me objectivity. Okay. And when you're objective and when you're neutral, you can actually change things. Okay, this didn't go well. What can I change over here? But when you're just like, oh my God, I'm a terrible person and I'm a terrible physician and all of it just bleeds into each other, you can't separate the two. And a lot of the burnout then starts to come from there as well.
And it sounds like that self-compassion is necessary for setting those boundaries. If you are someone who's caring about yourself and your own self-worth, and you're trying to be good to yourself, you're going to be able to set those boundaries. But if you're putting everyone else's needs in front of your own, you are not practicing self-compassion.
Absolutely. And for me, self-compassion might be the ultimate form of self-care because I think that really when I looked at Dr. Neff's work surrounding how self-compassion was actually more motivating and you procrastinate less, I was like, okay, done. Let me try and practice this because I hate procrastinating.
Oh, I'm screwing on my phone again. Yeah. Wait, sorry. I just want to end on that because that's going to be super useful for me in particular because I do enough of that. I would certainly like to procrastinate less. So how do I use self-compassion to procrastinate less?
You ask yourself, when the procrastinating situation is happening, there is likely two reasons. Reason number one is the task is mundane and you are somehow waiting. For example, I always give the example of folding laundry. I shall never find it delightful. And instead of waiting that all of a sudden, somehow something is going to inspire me to fold laundry, I have just decided this is a mundane task. Delaying it is not going to get better. And I can be kind to myself for not liking this. Not liking to fold laundry doesn't mean that something's inherently wrong with me. And so when you have, that is a form of self-compassion right there. It allows you to move past that mundane task and accomplish it. Now, if this task is a little bit bigger, for example, going for a promotion, submitting a project, when there are more things on the line, you are, by procrastinating, what you are trying to do is you don't want to face yourself on the other side, because when you will fail, you will be so hard on yourself that you don't even want to take that first step. So if you decide that I'm always going to have my back, I'm going to give this thing my best shot, and if I don't pass or I don't succeed or whatever the outcome is, I will still have myself to turn to, it will be easier for you to actually go and try and explore and be willing to fail, rather than when you fail, you already know that the stick is going to be waiting for you at the other side.
Fantastic advice. Well, I look forward to hearing many of your interviews. And for those of you who want to follow her online, again, a fantastic social media presence. So you can find her at earlycareerphysician.com or on Instagram, Dr. Amna Shabir. That's S-H-A-B-B-I-R. And anywhere else that you'd like to for people to find you, or anything else you want to mention about yourself?
My first and last name on LinkedIn, but thank you so much. That was very all-encompassing.
Well, Dr. Amna Shabir, thank you so much for what you do for our colleagues and for your patients. Doctors dedicate our lives to caring for others. It's time someone took care of us. Visit patternlife.com to simplify your path to peace of mind. Patternlife.com, simplifying your insurance journey. Thanks for listening. I have a favor to ask. You listened to the episode until the end, which means you either fell asleep or you really liked the episode. So please share it or like it or comment on a social media post or write us a 5-star review, something. It would really help me out. And maybe what you learned from this episode can help someone else too. The views expressed in this episode are those of the interviewer and interviewee and don't represent the views of their employer or even their significant other. Even though the magic of podcasting make it sound like I'm talking directly to you, this is not a doctor-patient relationship, and this is not medical advice or financial advice or really any advice. Thank us again for listening to The Physician's Guide to Doctoring.